A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Hey, Herman and Corin. So I'm really enjoying listening to that episode about DMX controls in theatrical productions. And yes, it does sound like another weird topic for my word prompts. But I grew up whenever my mum and my sister, whenever we traveled to London, my mum and sister are major musical fans. So we'd go to see the musical. And, you know, I can't say that The Lion King is maybe my cup, the first thing I'd see. If I was on the West End or Broadway. But I just remember being fascinated by the technical production first and foremost. You know, when you go in and you take your seat and you pass this guy or guys and girls, whoever, with this huge bank of monitors and panels and switches. And I guess what made an impression on me, less so than the actual musical, was just the caliber of the theatrical production. You know, you've got an orchestra, you've got the onstage audio. And I've done a bit of sound gear in my own little way for YouTube productions, corporate videography, that kind of thing. But unless you're doing something like this, you don't really get involved in DMX arrays for lights. I mean, you might know how to light a scene for an interview, but that's quite a different thing than rigging up a, you know, a 400 tungsten bulb lighting array. So learning about how that aspect works was fascinating. And I remember looking at this stuff on YouTube before. I love getting those YouTube behind the scenes type videos where someone brings you into their world. And it was an interview with a technical director on a Broadway production. And what struck me, and you mentioned this in your episode, was the importance of these cue sheets, as they're called, that they literally have to memorize almost. I mean, they're written out, but they, when you've got a cue every few seconds, and these are, as you said, each light with a color temperature, with a brightness value, with custom set transitions, each one is meticulously crafted for a point in the production. And the guy pressing those buttons isn't just kind of like randomly slapping things on a panel. They're integral to it. So anyway, super interesting. Really enjoyed that one. I want to ask you, Herman and Corin, even by my standards, I'll admit, this is a tenuous transition between episode topics, but hear me out. So I'm looking around at our place, and I spent the last 2 days working my tail off, getting everything that can be decluttered, baby-proofing, discarding things we don't need, writing little identifiers on our outdoor furniture that's weatherproof. And I'm doing this because in 2 months we're moving, and I can't say we really are looking forward to this. But given that it's been our, I'm going to say, fourth move in a very volatile rental market, I've become, I wouldn't say obsessed, but very, very particular about organizing and labeling for this reason, because I've seen that it actually does make a big difference. The more organized and light, importantly, your stuff is before you move, the less you're going to be paying to move stuff that you don't need, and the easier, when it rolls off the moving truck, you're going to reassemble your life, basically. The thing I've done differently from my previous jaunts is, between this move and the last one, we set up a home network. And it's one of those things that you start with the server, next thing you know, we got into Home Assistant. I've got little SBC computers around the place, and IP cameras for watching Ezra, and a couple of screens. And I got into OpenSense precisely because I didn't want to have to do this again. So I'm, again, last few days, also checked that all the static IPs are set. And I'd love to think that we're in a position whereby, as soon as we find a suitable place, we can roll in and roll out the moving truck, that is. But Herman and Corin, I love learning from people who do things really, really well. And we covered in a previous episode way back in the history. I mentioned that two groups of people stand out to me as, if these guys don't know how to do this efficiently, nobody does. Number one was the military. And I mentioned that because of their specialized networking gear. Any military has to deploy to different places with a network that they don't have time to set up in a remote environment. And the other one was roadies. And that brings me back to the theatrical connection. People who, you know, productions that, again, they have their own internal networks, they have their gear. And what I'd love to know is how both of these groups, or other groups, I'm just picking two examples that stood out to me, get to be superb at moving. We could probably add diplomatic families while we're at it to that group. People who basically have taken the tedium of moving, and it really is tedium, at least some parts of it here in Israel, but they've made it as good as possible by being as organized as possible. And what would those guys be doing if they were moving in a couple of months, you know, to get their things? Is there anything you can do at this stage to get your belongings ready for move day? So you can just kind of prepare for the move. Maybe even we're thinking about paying a couple of weeks of double rent just to not have it chaotic again, and hopefully make this the last move that we do. But that's another story about the rental market. Herman and Corin, let's talk about moving tips from the pros in today's episode of My Word Prompts.
Daniel sent us this one, and I have to say, I appreciate the honesty in the setup. He basically admitted this is a tenuous bridge between episodes, but the logic actually tracks. He's moving in 2 months. He's been decluttering, baby-proofing, labeling, checking static IPs on his home network. And his question is, if the military and touring roadies are the two groups who've absolutely mastered the art of packing up and moving complex operations, what tips would those pros give someone like him trying to make a move as smooth as possible?
Diplomatic families he threw them in too, which, by the way, is spot on. These are people who move every 2 to 3 years, sometimes to entirely different continents, and they have it down to a science. I've been reading up on this, and the overlap between how a road crew handles a tour loadout and how a foreign service officer handles a permanent change of station is genuinely striking.
Before we dig in, quick note. DeepSeek V4 Pro is writing our script today, which feels appropriate given we're talking about precision and discipline.
Okay, so let's start with the roadies, because that's where Daniel's theatrical connection applies. A touring production is essentially a mobile infrastructure operation. You've got lighting rigs, sound systems, video walls, sometimes automated scenery, all of which has to be packed into trucks, driven to the next city, unloaded, and reassembled in a venue that the crew has never seen before. And they do this sometimes with a turnaround of less than 24 hours.
Which is insane when you think about it. The same crew that just ran a 3-hour show is now loading out until 4 in the morning.
The thing that makes it work, and this is where the home mover can actually steal something useful, is that road crews do not make decisions during loadout. Every single decision was made weeks earlier. The case that holds the follow spot has a specific label, a specific place in a specific truck, and a specific position on the next dock. Nobody is standing there going, where should we put this?
That's the first principle, isn't it? Decision fatigue is the real enemy of a move. By the time you're on hour 6 of packing, you're making terrible choices. You're throwing the cast iron skillet into a box with the baby's stuffed animals because you've stopped caring.
And the military figured this out too. I was reading through a PCS, that's permanent change of station, a PCS guide from a logistics officer, and the entire philosophy is separate planning from execution. You have a binder, and that binder contains every single thing you need to know. Floor plans of the new place, an inventory with weight estimates, a color-coded room map, a timeline that goes backwards from move day.
Wait, backwards from move day?
Yeah, this is a technique called reverse planning. You start with the moment the truck arrives at the new place, and you work backwards. If the truck arrives at 8 a.m. Saturday, then loading happens Friday, then the boxes need to be sealed and labeled by Thursday night, which means packing non-essentials starts the previous Monday. You build the entire schedule by asking, what has to be true for this next step to happen?
That's so much better than the civilian approach, which is basically, the movers come Tuesday, so I'll start packing Monday night and hope for the best. Which I've done. I'm not proud of it.
Most people have. But here's the roadie version of the same idea. On a major tour, they use something called a case inventory system. Every road case has a unique identifier, and inside that case is a manifest, a laminated sheet that lists exactly what's supposed to be in there. When they pack up after a show, they check against the manifest. When they unpack at the next venue, they check again. If something's missing, they know within minutes, not days.
For Daniel, who's already doing the labeling thing, he mentioned writing identifiers on outdoor furniture. The next level would be to create a master inventory that travels separately from the boxes. A spreadsheet, a notebook, something that says box A1 contains kitchen utensils, weighs roughly 15 kilos, and belongs in the kitchen at the new place.
That A1 label? That's not random. The military uses a room code system that's beautifully simple. Every room in the new house gets a color and a number. Kitchen is red, bedroom one is blue, whatever. Every box gets a colored sticker with the room code. When the movers arrive at the new place, they don't need to ask where anything goes. They look at the sticker, they look at the door, which has the same color sticker on it, and they put the box in the right room.
That's the kind of thing that sounds like overkill, until you've spent 45 minutes moving boxes from the wrong room. Because someone stacked everything in the living room, and you have to sort it out while your toddler is crying and you can't find the kettle.
Ezra will be in the middle of this, by the way. Daniel mentioned baby-proofing. Moving with a toddler adds a whole layer of complexity that the roadies don't have to deal with, but diplomats absolutely do.
Right. Diplomatic families. You said they move every 2 to 3 years.
Sometimes more frequently. And here's the thing. The State Department and equivalent foreign services have formalized this. They provide what's called a consumable shipment, an air freight shipment, and a sea freight shipment. Each one has a different arrival time and a different purpose. The air freight arrives within a week or two and contains the stuff you need to function immediately. Clothes, basic kitchen items, some toys for the kids, essential electronics. The sea freight takes months and has everything else.
Daniel's idea about paying for a couple weeks of double rent? That's essentially creating his own air freight window. He's buying time so he's not unpacking the sea freight equivalent in a panic on day one.
And diplomats take this further. They maintain what's called a welcome kit. A clearly marked box or set of boxes that contains the first night essentials. Bed linens, towels, toilet paper, a shower curtain, basic toiletries, phone chargers, a couple of days of clothes, snacks, a coffee maker, some basic tools. That box goes in the car, not the truck. It never leaves your sight.
I've done versions of that, but calling it a welcome kit and actually packing it as a deliberate separate unit, that's a mental shift. Most people just kind of vaguely think, oh, I'll keep this suitcase with me, and then at the last minute they throw random things in it, and it's half useless.
The roadies have the same concept. It's called the workbox. It's a single road case that contains tools, spare cables, gaff tape, sharpies, batteries, a multi-tool, first aid kit. It's the first thing off the truck and the last thing back on. Nobody touches it except the crew chief.
If I'm Daniel, I'm creating a welcome kit that's packed and sealed 2 days before the move, and I'm not touching it until I walk into the new place.
You're putting in the things you actually need, not the things you think you'll need. This is where an inventory of your last move becomes incredibly valuable. What did you desperately search for in the first 3 hours? What did you not touch for 2 weeks? The diplomats I was reading about. There's a whole community of Foreign Service spouses who've created moving playbooks. They keep a lessons learned document after every move. What worked, what broke, what they wish they packed differently.
That's such a good practice. It's an after-action report, essentially. The military does that for everything, and civilians almost never do it for moves. You finish the move, you collapse on the couch, and you try to forget the whole experience. You don't document what went wrong, so you can fix it next time.
Because Daniel's done 4 moves in a volatile rental market, he's actually in a position to do this. He probably remembers, with painful clarity, what went sideways last time. Writing that down now, before the move, and designing systems to prevent those specific failures. That's exactly what a good production manager does on a tour.
Let's talk about the network stuff, because that's where Daniel's situation is more complex than a typical move. He's got a home server, home assistant, SBCs, single board computers, IP cameras, OPN sense. He mentioned he's already checked that all the static IPs are set, which is smart. But what would a road crew do with a network that has to be torn down and rebuilt?
This is where the touring world has useful parallels. A modern concert tour has a network that's shockingly complex. You've got Dante Audio Networking, ArtNet or SACN for lighting, video distribution, intercom systems, sometimes separate networks for automation and pyrotechnics. and they have to set all of this up in a venue that might have completely different power, different physical layout, different everything.
How do they do it?
Documentation that borders on obsessive. Every device has a label with its IP address and its function. Every cable run is documented. But the key thing, and this is what I think Daniel might find useful, is that they don't configure anything from scratch at the venue. The entire network is pre-configured in what's called a shop build before the tour even starts. They set up the entire system in a warehouse, configure everything, test everything, and then label every single connection point. When they get to the venue, they're not configuring, they're reconnecting.
The principle is, do all the thinking work in advance, in a controlled environment, when you're not under time pressure. Then, the on-site work is purely physical.
For Daniel, that means he can do something really practical right now, 2 months before the move. He can document his entire network topology. Every device, its IP, its MAC address, which port it connects to, on which switch, what its function is. He can take photos of the back of the rack. He can label every cable. And he can create a diagram that shows how everything connects.
I'd go further. He could set up a test environment, even just a small switch and a couple of devices, and practice rebuilding a portion of the network from his documentation. If he can rebuild it from his notes without looking at the current setup, his documentation is good. If he can't, he's got gaps.
That's literally what the military calls a communications exercise. Before a deployment, they'll set up and tear down their comms gear multiple times until it's muscle memory. The goal is to discover problems in a low-stakes environment.
Daniel's got the advantage of Opiant Sense, which is a firewall and routing platform. One thing I'd recommend, and this comes from the enterprise IT world, but it applies here, is to back up the Opiant Sense configuration. A full config backup. Store it on a USB stick that goes in the welcome kit. If something goes catastrophically wrong, he can restore the entire firewall configuration from that backup, instead of rebuilding rules from memory.
And for the IP cameras and Home Assistant, the labeling is everything. In a touring rack, every cable has a label at both ends that says what it is and where it goes. Not just camera 1. Something like Ezra's room cam PoE port 3 on switch B IP. 192.168.1.50. If a cable gets unplugged and you're staring at a tangle of identical looking Ethernet runs, those labels are the difference between 10 minutes of troubleshooting and 2 hours of despair.
I've lived that 2 hours of despair. It's not fun. So to summarize the network piece, document everything now, label everything, backup configs, and treat the documentation as the deliverable. The move is just the implementation.
Let's talk about the physical packing, because this is where the roadies have techniques that most civilians never think about. The first one is weight distribution. A road case for a lighting console might weigh 200 pounds. It's packed, so the center of gravity is low and the case can be tipped onto a truck ramp without wanting to fall over. For a home move, the equivalent is, don't pack a large box full of books. Everyone does this. The box weighs 80 pounds, the bottom blows out, and someone throws out their back.
The rule I've heard is, books go in small boxes, heavy things go in small boxes, light things go in big boxes. But people instinctively do the opposite. They see a big box and think, I can fit more stuff in here.
Road crews use standardized case sizes for a reason. When every case is a known dimension, you can pack a truck like a three-dimensional puzzle. For a home move, you don't need custom road cases, but using a limited number of box sizes, say small, medium, and large, all from the same supplier, makes the truck pack dramatically more efficient. If you've got 17 different box sizes from random grocery store collections, you're going to waste space.
Daniel mentioned he's been decluttering, which is step one and honestly the most important thing. The military calls this purging before a PCS move. You don't pay to move things you don't need. And with weight-based moving costs, which are common, every kilo of decluttered junk is money back in your pocket.
There's a rule of thumb from professional organizers that I think applies here. If you haven't used it in a year, you probably don't need it. But for a move, I'd tighten that. If you haven't used it since the last move, and you moved 2 years ago, it should not come with you to the next place.
Unless it's seasonal or sentimental. But even then, sentimental items can be digitized or photographed. I'm not saying throw out your grandmother's letters, but maybe you don't need to move that box of old cables you've been saving just in case.
The cable box. Every household has one. Every road crew has a cable trunk, but the difference is their cable trunk is organized and every cable is tested before it goes in. If a cable is bad, it gets thrown out or repaired. It doesn't just sit in the trunk for 5 years.
Daniel, if you're listening, test your cables. The HDMI that worked 3 years ago might not work now. The Ethernet cable that's been coiled and uncoiled 50 times might have a break. Test them or toss them.
Another roadie technique that translates beautifully, the last on, first off rule. The things you need immediately at the new place go in the truck last, so they come off first. This is the opposite of how most people pack. They pack the essentials first because they're using them up until the last minute. Then those boxes end up buried behind everything else.
That's the welcome kit we talked about, but it also applies to larger items. If you know you'll need the vacuum cleaner within the first hour, because moving is dusty and things spill, the vacuum goes in last.
The military has a specific procedure for this. They call it the first night box, or survival kit, and it's not just a suggestion, it's part of the official move plan. It typically includes bedding, a shower curtain, towels, toiletries, basic kitchen items, a few changes of clothes, medications, important documents, and chargers. The key is that this box is self-contained. You could live out of it for 3 days if the rest of your stuff got delayed.
Moving trucks break down. Moves get rescheduled. If you've got a toddler, you cannot afford to be without the essentials.
Speaking of toddlers, and this is where the diplomatic community has wisdom that the roadies don't, one of the things Foreign Service families emphasize is setting up the kids' room first. Before the kitchen, before the living room, before anything else. The kids' beds get set up, their familiar toys get unpacked, their nightlight gets plugged in. The goal is to create one stable, familiar space in an unfamiliar environment. It reduces the chaos for the kids, and it gives the parents one less thing to worry about while they unpack.
That's really smart. Ezra's at the age where his environment matters a lot for his mood and sleep. If his room feels like home on night one, everything else is more manageable.
Daniel's already thinking about this with the baby-proofing. He's doing the hazard assessment now, which is exactly right. In a new place, you don't know where the sharp corners are, where the outlets are, where the stairs are. Doing a safety walkthrough before the furniture goes in is much easier than trying to baby-proof around furniture.
Let's talk about the color-coding system in more detail, because I think this is the single highest impact thing Daniel could implement. How does the military do it?
The standard approach is, you assign a color to each room, and you put that color on a floor plan that everyone can see. Then, every box gets a sticker or a piece of colored tape with that room's color. On move day, you put colored signs on the doors of the new place. The movers don't need to read labels, they don't need to ask questions, they match colors.
You can do this with cheap colored duct tape. Red for kitchen, blue for master bedroom, green for Ezra's room, yellow for living room, whatever. The key is consistency and visibility.
Some military families take it further. They number the boxes within each color, kitchen 1 of 8, kitchen 2 of 8, etc., and keep a master list of what's in each numbered box. That way, if they need the waffle maker on day 2, they know it's in kitchen box 3, and they don't have to open every kitchen box to find it.
That level of granularity might be overkill for some people, but Daniel seems like the type who'd appreciate it. He's already writing identifiers on outdoor furniture. He's already in the mindset.
Here's the thing. This system doesn't take that much time to set up. Maybe an extra hour or two of planning and labeling. But on the back end, it saves days. A move where every box goes to the right room on the first trip is fundamentally different from a move where boxes are stacked randomly and you spend the next week shuffling things around.
The roadies have a version of this too. In a touring production, every case has a case label that includes the show name, the contents, the weight, and which truck it goes in. The truck pack is planned in advance, literally a diagram of which case goes where. They don't figure it out on the dock at 2 a.m.
There's a famous story, and I think this is from the Broadway world, about a production manager who would photograph the inside of every road case before it left the shop. Then, during load-in at the next venue, if a local crew member was helping unpack, they could see exactly how the case was supposed to look when repacked.
That's brilliant! Take photos of everything before you pack it. Your bookshelf, your kitchen drawers, your closet. Not because you need to recreate everything exactly, but because a photo is a fast reference when you're trying to remember how you had things organized.
For the network gear, photos are essential. Take photos of the back of the rack. Take photos of which cable goes where. Take photos of the labels. If you're tired and frustrated and nothing's working, those photos are your ground truth.
Let's talk about the thing nobody wants to talk about, which is the emotional side of moving. The military and diplomatic communities have actually developed coping strategies for this because they move so often.
One of the things that comes up repeatedly in Foreign Service moving guides is the concept of closing out, a post or a home. It's a deliberate process of saying goodbye. You walk through each room, you acknowledge the memories, and you mentally close that chapter. It sounds a little touchy-feely, but the people who skip this step often report feeling unmoored in the new place.
I can see that. If you just pack everything frantically and bolt, you arrive at the new place with this unresolved sense of having fled the old one.
For kids, this is even more important. The diplomatic playbook says, let the kids have a say in how their room is set up in the new place. Let them pack a special box of their favorite things that they carry themselves. Give them a sense of agency in a process that otherwise feels like it's happening to them.
Ezra's too young for that level of participation, but even at his age, having his familiar things around, his blanket, his stuffed animals, his books, that continuity matters.
Another military technique, the inventory binder, is not just for logistics. Some families include photos of the old home, notes about neighbors, favorite local restaurants, the name of the park where the kids played. It becomes a kind of scrapbook of each posting. Over a career, you end up with a shelf of these binders, and they're a record of a life lived in many places.
That's actually beautiful. And it reframes moving from this awful thing you endure to something you document and learn from.
Let's talk about the double rent idea Daniel mentioned, because I think it's worth examining from a cost-benefit perspective. Paying for two places for a couple of weeks feels expensive, but what's the cost of a chaotic move?
The cost of a chaotic move is broken items, lost items, marital stress, lost work days, take out food for 2 weeks because you can't find the kitchen stuff, back pain from rushing, and a general sense of living in chaos for a month.
If you're self-employed or working remotely, which Daniel does in AI and tech comms, lost workdays have a direct dollar value. If a chaotic move costs you 5 days of productive work, and the double rent costs the equivalent of 3 days of work, you're actually ahead by paying the double rent.
The military essentially does this by design. They provide temporary lodging allowance between moves. They know that you can't go from one house to another in a single day and be functional. There's a transition period.
The roadie equivalent is the dark day, a day between shows where no performance happens. It's built into the tour schedule. You don't do a show in Chicago on Saturday night and a show in Denver on Sunday. You need the travel day, the load-in day. The schedule acknowledges that transitions take time.
Daniel paying for a couple weeks of overlap isn't an indulgence. It's building a dark day into his move schedule. It's acknowledging that transition takes time and planning for it.
One more military technique that I think is underrated, the do not pack zone. In the days leading up to a move, you designate one room or one area, usually a bathroom or a closet, where you put everything that should not go on the truck. Car keys, passports, the welcome kit, medications, the kids' favorite toys, the laptop, the important documents folder. Everything in that zone is off limits to movers. You put a sign on the door that says do not pack in large letters.
You check that zone multiple times before the truck leaves, because movers are efficient, and they will pack anything that isn't nailed down if you don't stop them.
Stories abound of movers packing the cat's litter box, with the cat in it, or packing the trash can with actual trash still inside. The do not pack zone prevents those disasters.
The cat's story is probably apocryphal, but I choose to believe it.
The trash can one is definitely real. I've heard it from multiple sources. Movers are on a schedule, and they're not paid to make judgment calls about what's trash and what's not.
If you're Daniel 2 months out, what's the timeline look like? I think we can actually build this out based on the military and roadie approaches.
2 months out is the planning phase. This is when you create the floor plan of the new place. Even if you don't know exactly which place yet, you can sketch out rooms based on what you're looking for. You assign colors to rooms. You start the inventory. You begin decluttering, focusing on one room per weekend so it doesn't become overwhelming.
1 month out, you're in the logistics phase. You've booked movers or a truck. You've ordered boxes and packing supplies, and you've ordered more than you think you need, because running out of boxes on packing day is a nightmare. You've started packing non-essential items, off-season clothes, books, decorative items, anything you won't need in the next 30 days.
2 weeks out, you're packing in earnest. The welcome kit is assembled and sealed. The network documentation is complete and the config backups are on a USB stick. You've taken photos of everything. The do not pack zone is established.
1 week out, you're packing everything except daily essentials. You're eating off paper plates. You're living out of suitcases. The house looks bare and it feels weird, but that's the goal. By the time the movers arrive, everything that's left is either in a labeled box or in the do not pack zone.
The night before, you do a final walkthrough. Check every closet, every cabinet, every drawer. Check the attic, the basement, the shed. Check behind doors. Movers will take what you leave, but they won't come back if you forget something.
Move day. The color-coded signs are on the doors. The welcome kit is in your car. The do not pack zone is clearly marked. You do a final sweep after the truck is loaded, and then you leave.
At the new place, the color-coded signs go up before the truck arrives. The movers match boxes to rooms. The welcome kit is the first thing you open. You set up beds first, then the kitchen, then everything else. And you don't try to unpack everything on day one.
I think that last point is important. The military and diplomatic communities both emphasize that unpacking is a marathon, not a sprint. You aim to have the kitchen functional by day two, the bedrooms set up by day three, and everything else can take weeks. You don't kill yourself trying to have the whole house perfect by Sunday night.
You do the after-action report. Within a week of the move, while it's still fresh, you write down what worked and what didn't. Which boxes were packed well, which ones fell apart. What you wish you'd packed differently. What you're glad you decluttered. That document becomes your playbook for the next move.
Daniel's done 4 moves. He's probably got a lot of this knowledge already, even if he hasn't formalized it. The difference with this move is that he's approaching it deliberately, with systems and planning, rather than just reacting.
The network adds complexity, but it also adds an opportunity. If he documents everything properly now, the next move, and there will probably be a next move given the rental market, will be dramatically easier. He'll have the playbook. He'll have the config backups. He'll have the network diagram. He'll be able to tear down and rebuild in a fraction of the time.
One thing we haven't talked about is the mental shift that roadies and military people make. They don't see moving as an interruption to their real life. Moving is part of the job. It's a skill to be developed, not a disaster to be endured. That reframing actually matters.
When a touring crew finishes a show, loadout isn't an annoying thing they have to do before they can go to bed. Loadout is the job. The show is the job too, but loadout is equally the job, and they take pride in doing it well.
Daniel seems to have made that shift. He's not dreading the move, or maybe he is, but he's also approaching it as a project to be optimized. He's looking for best practices. He's studying how the pros do it.
The pros across all 3 groups we've looked at, roadies, military, diplomats, converge on the same principles. Plan separately from execution. Create a first night kit. Color code by room. Document your systems. Do an after action review. Treat the move as a skill, not a crisis.
The specifics vary. A road case isn't a cardboard box. A PCS move isn't a tour loadout. But the principles are remarkably consistent. And they're all applicable to a civilian move, whether you're moving across Jerusalem or across the country.
One last thing from the diplomatic world that I think is worth mentioning, the consumables shipment. Concept. Diplomats get a separate shipment for consumables, food, toiletries, cleaning supplies, things that run out. The logic is that you don't want to arrive in a new country and immediately have to figure out where to buy laundry detergent. For a domestic move, the equivalent is stock the welcome kit with the consumables you'll need in the first week. Toilet paper, paper towels, dish soap, trash bags, basic groceries. You're not going to do a full grocery run on move day. Having those things on hand removes a surprising amount of stress.
The first grocery run after a move is always overwhelming. You're tired, the store is unfamiliar, you can't find anything, and you end up buying random things you don't need while forgetting the one thing you actually came for. Having a buffer of basics in the welcome kit means that grocery run can happen on day 3 instead of day 1.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1860s, the Shilluk people of South Sudan produced a distinctive red-brown body paint by mixing iron-rich clay with fermented cow's milk, which was left to curdle for several days until the pigment deepened to the color of dried blood. The resulting paste was considered both decorative and spiritually protective.
Right. The question Daniel's left with, and I think it's the right question, is what happens after this move? He mentioned hoping this is the last one for a while. The rental market in Jerusalem is what it is. But the systems he's building now, the documentation, the labeling discipline, the network configuration backups, those don't expire. They make every subsequent move easier.
They make daily life easier, too. Knowing where things are, having your network documented, having an inventory of your possessions, that's useful even if you never move again. It's just good household management.
This has been my Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop. You can find every episode at My Weird Prompts.
If you enjoyed this, leave us a review wherever you get your podcasts. We'll be back soon.
This episode was generated using Gemini Flash 3. Text-to-speech engine was Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth's slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My Weird Prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long ear host. My Weird Prompts, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.